Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. Very nice to have you with us. Listening to the Westerlies this morning playing at Tourists in North Adams, Massachusetts on Thursday. And you can find out more about that really cool place and that really cool group at touristswelcome.com. Touristswelcome.com. We'll be playing that throughout the morning this morning. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Roundtable and to our panel on this Tuesday, the 18th of June. A pleasure to have you all aboard. Let me introduce our panel to you and then remind you how you can join in on the fun. That's simple. It is panel@wamc.org. We would love your letters. We need your letters. We really do rely on them. So panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you. Alan is out today. However, we do expect him to be back tomorrow, but he is out today. So let me introduce who we have left. We have Libby Post, who is our political consultant and was with us yesterday, is with us today, and we're very excited to have you here.
Oh, thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Good morning. The Empire Report's J.P. Miller joins us. Good morning, J.P. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you, Joe?
I'm fine. Thank you for asking.
Good.
And former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain joins us. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, again, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A lot to talk about this morning. We will get started right now. And again, we do welcome your letters because they are always important. Let's talk with, we'll spend just a few moments on Iran and on this story and the tensions there. This is obviously something that the world is watching. The president has added troops after Iran says it will breach the nuclear deal. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran flared on Monday as Tehran said it would soon breach a key element of the 2015 international pact limiting its nuclear program, while President Trump ordered another 1,000 troops to the Middle East and vowed again that Iran would not be allowed to develop a nuclear weapon. The Pentagon's announcement of the troop deployment came 3 days after attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman that the administration has blamed Iran for. And it came hours after Iran said it was within days of violating a central element of the landmark 2015 agreement intended to curb its ability to develop a nuclear weapon unless European nations agreed to help it blunt crippling American economic sanctions. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization said that within 10 days the country will have produced and kept in its stockpiles more low-enriched uranium, the sort used to fuel power plants, than allowed by the 2015 containment deal. Mike, what do you think? Where are we in this?
Well, there's no question that Iran sees opportunities, and they are a dastardly bunch, and they've done some awful things. But what's surprising to me is, as the Trump administration and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, asserts that they have definitive proof that Iran is attacking these tankers, our allies are skeptical. They want more proof. And you know, they may well have done it. I don't think they're innocent, no question. But the fact that our own allies are unwilling to just take our word for it just shows you the sad state of our relations with, you know, just a week after the celebration of D-Day, how badly we get along with our former closest allies.
I was going to say former closest allies, because we really at this point don't know who our allies are, do we? I mean, other than, say, the Saudis, who else do we have in our corner right now?
I think the UK is cautiously trying to back us and say they're, you know, at least giving us lip service, because
they have their own problems now.
They are mired in their own internal problems currently, and not without some interference by our own president, who has already weighed in on what they should do. But in any event, it does show how much things have deteriorated since Trump immediately pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal that the Obama administration and other world leaders had brokered.
Yeah, as I read this, I see the tension emerging between John Bolton, who's certainly the most hawkish foreign policy advisor in the White House, and the less hawkish, I would say, President and Secretary of State Pompeo. I think and hope that the troop movements that we're seeing are more preventative measures to try and stop acts like what happened last week from happening again. And I am excited that we every article I read, it says that officials are saying that any military action right now is still highly, highly unlikely.
But, you know, I remember reading either earlier this week or late last week, it's all sort of a blur, that Iran is announced that it's going to do more plutonium and start producing more in total defiance of the deal that we pulled out of.
Right. So they're poking the West.
Yeah.
And China and Russia, which were signatories to the nuclear deal, don't seem bothered by it. They're continuing to buy oil from them. And, it just shows that they're taking this opportunity where Trump is getting militaristic and using it to gain a little more ground, to go a little farther. And the allies in Europe that want to support the nuclear pact, that don't have the U.S. backing anymore to support the nuclear pact, and yet they don't want to see Iran nuclearize and become a nuclear, develop a nuclear weapon. They're torn in the middle of all this. And there's economic issues, too, because there is a lot of benefit to being able to sell to Iran. And a lot of European countries are really relying on that. A lot of American companies had relied on that, and they don't have that opportunity now.
But back to your point, Mike, of this idea of our allies and who they are right now, how we have to start discussing, don't we, as to what we do about that situation, that whatever the world crisis is at the moment, that we have ostracized ourselves in many ways, shapes, and forms, that you hope, if something horrible happened, that we could come together, but you wonder if that's possible.
Well, fortunately, I think that the leaders of the Western countries, European countries primarily, do see the long game. They know there's an election in the U.S. in 2020. They don't know the outcome. Nobody knows the outcome. I'm sure we'll talk about that a little later.
Yes, we'll
another topic.
Try to preview that.
But they need to just sort of chill a little bit and see what happens with United States foreign policy, because it is dramatically different than it was 2.5 years ago when President Obama left the White House. And in 2.5 more years, it could be dramatically different should there be somebody else in the White House. Or if President Trump is reelected, it could be dramatically different in a different direction. So their best strategy seems to be what they're doing is maintaining polite, pleasant relations with the U.S., moving in their own direction, watching out for their own self-interest, of course. That's what every country does. And waiting out to see what happens.
You know, I think we can see the typical Trump scenario playing out here. He creates this problem, and then he has a conversation, ostensibly with somebody who will... Then he can then say, oh, don't worry about it. I've taken care of it, which was his thing, you know, during the campaign. Don't worry. I'll take care of everything. I can solve all our foreign policy
It was
problems.
The Mexico
right.
deal that
right.
really was already brokered.
Right, right. And he, so he can right, do the yeah. same thing here and to be able to say, no, we're not going to go to war. And look, I took care of this.
I kept us out of war.
Right. That's exactly it. I'll keep us out of war and look, you know, and look what a great guy
works.
I am.
I mean, you know,
it works
all fairness,
with some people.
In all fairness— politicians do that kind of thing.
Yes, they do.
They generate a lot of bluster over something, and then when it doesn't happen, they take credit for resolving it.
Yes. They create a problem
right.
that they can solve.
That's right. That's exactly
to make it
right.
look better.
That's right.
Yeah, and Trump does that more overtly,
yeah.
but other politicians on the local and state level do it. The national
yes,
level
but
have done it.
But it's not But unfortunately, it's not so dangerous.
Yes,
I mean,
the thing is,
you know, if a local politician does something like that, it's not as dangerous as getting us into World War III.
But also, and it is just fair to point out, I think, I certainly agree with all of you on this subject, but, you know, he didn't create the problems of the Middle East.
No, but he is certainly exacerbating them with sending his son-in-law to go be the peacekeeper in Israel, who, you know, hasn't been able to produce anything in 2.5 years, and with pulling out of the Iran deal, doing business with the Saudis, the people who blew up the Twin Towers, doing all of these things that are totally antithetical to every single seasoned, intellectual, experienced foreign policy person in this country. You know, you go to the Department of State, not Mike Pompeo, anybody who was there before then, you know, they'll all be like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know, so because he's doing business with the enemy in a major way.
In some ways, but in some ways, aren't we now trying to enforce the Iran deal that we wanted to get out of?
You know, that is the irony here. We're using their violation of the deal that we no longer honor, and they're violating or beginning to violate some aspects of that deal by generating low-level uranium and keeping it plutonium and keeping it in the country instead of exporting it like they had agreed to, and by doing that, we're ramming up our defenses and our rhetoric, because they're not honoring something that we don't honor.
Well, honoring it because Trump pulled out of it. Before Trump pulled out of it, we honored it. So to say that we didn't want to be part of it is not true. You know, the deal got cut by Obama. That's the issue. If the deal had been cut by George Bush, it would still be standing. Anything that Obama has done, Trump is trying to reverse. And that is one of the biggest things that he did, was to put us in some degree of safety regarding Iran and nuclear proliferation.
Obama
did. Some
people disagreed at the time.
Sure,
I mean, it was highly contentious.
But the thing, we did make the deal, and so did all of our allies. Okay, you know, many, many of our allies signed on to the Iran deal.
Yeah, I think people were reluctant, but they wanted to.
They wanted to rein them in.
Open the door,
right?
Yeah,
they wanted to rein them
dialogue
in.
Dialogue,
yeah, because it's the only way to do it. And you know, it's called diplomacy. Something this administration doesn't really understand or knows how to define.
Well, I don't know that they don't understand it. I think
they don't care about it. Yeah, right.
Well, and it's different, right? I mean, we keep on talking about. Diplomacy is now, we use the word deal instead.
Yeah, right.
Right. Right. It's brokering deals. It's using force. It's a lot like a real estate deal where you offer this much and I offer something much, much lower, and we come somewhere in between and then boast that we got a great deal.
Right. Where do you think this is going to go over the next couple of days?
I think these other countries are going to try to continue to keep the volume down on their end, and hopefully I think that our administration is going to want to do the same. It's in everybody's interest not to continue to elevate and escalate tensions with Iran.
Well, people will be looking.
You're shaking, Libby.
Don't think that this administration has that degree of finesse. Okay, I don't think they understand that. I don't think they care. They understand. I don't think they care. I think that John Bolton wants to manufacture a war, because we are a military-industrial complex, and we need a war in order to feed that. This is what they do. This is exactly what they do. This is Iraq all over again, only a lot more dangerous.
Yeah, I see Bolton as a hawk, and he makes me very nervous. But Trump is not someone who has shown that he wants to get into militaristic, conflicts with other countries. He's been in there for for 3 years, and he hasn't done it yet, and he's certainly had a lot of opportunity to, and I don't see him seeing that as a benefit to his reelection. I think that's really what he's cared about. That's what he cares about.
Well, it'll be interesting tonight as he officially launches his reelection campaign in a big rally in Florida, which we'll be talking about, I'm sure. What he does say, if anything, about Iran, people will be listening very carefully to hear whether he is kind of toning it down and whether this is going to, like so many other things we thought were going to explode, just kind of cool down a little bit and be on the back burner.
Right.
So that's the opportunity.
We'll
that
I wonder if anybody has polled the American people about the appetite for Americans of a conflict with Iran. I think it would be 110% to zero for wanting to get into that.
There is no appetite for that.
Yeah, I don't think. I'm sure they have polled. We'll find out soon, I guess. But I guess it's not too hard to think that most people wouldn't be for it.
Certainly Iran is aware of that.
Yes.
And they know that they can push the envelope a little bit by tweaking us and tweaking the West by manufacturing some more low-grade plutonium, you know, and that's violating the deal. And they know they can put their ships out in the Gulf and harass and perhaps even be participants in blowing them up. I mean, that's all up for debate. There's some question about the proof, but they are tweaking it.
We welcome your letters. They add a lot to the conversation. We love to hear from you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation, continue the panel after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Again, the Westerlies playing tourists in North Adams, Massachusetts on Thursday, June 20th. That is otherwise known as the day after tomorrow, for those of you keeping score. Touristswelcome.com is the web address to find out more information. Touristswelcome.com, right in North Adams, Massachusetts. We have a lot of letters. Let's get to those, then we'll continue. Mike Spain is here, J.P. Miller, and Libby Post. We welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org. Kevin writes, good morning. Trump will start a war with Iran and will say he is the only one that can handle it. Write that down. Well,
okay, I think we said that. Again, but that's okay.
I think that seems to be
sort
the
of what I said before.
But yes,
and then Mike said it. And, you know.
Well, it being, you know, having a crisis and saying I am the only one that can solve it is a
me. I'm never pissy.
Is a trait of a dictator.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
I'm not saying that he is a dictator, but it is a tactic that dictators over history.
No, he's a dictator wannabe. That's who he is. He wants to be a dictator.
As Bill Maher says, taking many pages out of the dictator playbook.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, that's
he absolutely is.
Yeah.
You know, it's autocracy beyond belief. I mean, he just wants to control everything without regard to anybody else.
David makes this point. If the U.S. does not honor our treaties, how can we expect other nations to respect our interests? Well, that asks the question that I guess we've been kind of dancing around all
morning. Well, we're the United States. We're bigger and better than everyone, and they better comply, because if they don't, they'll have to contend with us in our wrath. You know, and that's kind of the big stick policy, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, kind of, sort of.
So our good friend Stephen Gottlieb wrote and said, the news misrepresent what is happening on Iranian nuclear supplies. They have not changed their production levels. The difference has been that Trump's sanctions have blocked sale of the excess, and there are significant technical problems in ramping production down. So Trump gets to blame Iran for his own behavior.
Right. Steve makes a good point. It's a really complicated nuclear deal that was brokered back a few years ago with Iran. And one of them allows them to manufacture plutonium and export it where it's bought by other countries that are allowed to use it under this international agreement. And then they can give them pure uranium that they can use for nuclear power plants, and they can give them money for it. But because we pulled out of it, we have white, you know, we have restricted their ability to sell it internationally also. And I mean,
why doesn't some other country make plutonium than Iran? Why do they have to make it?
Look, you know, that
seems bizarre to me.
That was the whole debate that was going on 3 or 4 years ago when this deal was entered into. They assert their right as a sovereign nation
to do whatever they want.
To make it so that they can use the nuclear power plant that the United States built there in 1966 and fuel it and generate nuclear power. You know, that was back during the Shah when they were our allies. And, you know, I mean, a country should have the ability to control its destiny as long as it doesn't break any international law and threaten the existence of other countries. And when you're dealing with nuclear material, that's the fence that you have to walk on the top of. And it is all nuanced. It's all complicated. It's all detailed. And we're reducing it to tweets.
And it's tough because I think some countries, sure, they have a right to do what they want, but I feel like maybe producing plutonium is more of a privilege than a right. And some countries have abused that privilege such that
maybe
that country shouldn't produce it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was exactly what was at stake. It's whether they have earned the right to be trusted to produce it and use it peaceably. And that was the whole issue. And many in Congress and many in the U.S. didn't think they had, but the Obama administration went along with it. And the Trump administration has rejected it. And it has created this complicated problem that Steve Gottlieb identified. And it's all nuanced.
But there is some paternalistic perspectives here. You know, have they earned the right? Now, I don't think they should. Let me put it so
they haven't earned the right.
Everybody in radio land, I don't think they should. But the United States making this distinction and making this decision, have they earned the right?
We are the leader of the free world.
We were
until very recently.
Right, we were the leader of the free world.
Time to check the stats again in the paper this morning.
Right. So, you know, I just think it's part of the paternalistic perspective that America has always had regarding the world, and that, you know, our stuff goes. We're the ones who make those decisions.
In the post-World War II era, that has been the way it's been.
And look how well it worked out for us in various places, like Iran, like South America, you know, all the democracy building that we did that didn't work.
Well,
yeah,
you're right. It hasn't been that effective, and in many cases, we haven't built democracies. We've jacked up dictators and military strongmen. But our intentions are generally good.
Okay.
Well, all right. Go ahead.
Well, we also, I think, are de facto somewhat responsible for the security and peace in the Middle East a little bit. And so that is a little bit, we certainly do it ourselves, but it's also a little bit forced upon us because of our preeminence in
the world.
And for the record, we have done some awfully, awfully, awfully good things for the world too. We just haven't been perfect.
No, this is true. We have not been perfect. Okay, fine.
All right, let's go to Neil's letter. He said, the problem with being a serial liar is that no one believes you. On the rare occasion, you may be telling the truth. I believe that was illustrated to me as a child in the book Chicken Little.
Iran is falling.
Right? I mean, that's, okay. But point taken. Jim says, I'm not apologizing for this regime, but Iran has been able to keep from meeting their enriched uranium threshold by selling the excess product to other countries. Since the U.S. has effectively cut off their ability to export the uranium, they will now reach the limit unless they shut down, which the Iranians are apparently loath to consider since they view this industry as a source of badly needed revenue.
Yeah, I mean, that's the complicated that's a good description of the part of the complicated deal, and it's just not some black and white deal. Do this, don't do that. You know, it's much, much, much more nuanced.
In a letter that has a subject headline that says two head scratchers, Mike writes to us and says, one, I find it ironic that when it comes to Iran and the attacks on the oil tankers, Donald Trump and his people are more than willing to accept the findings of our intelligence community. However, when it comes to Russian interference in our electoral process, Trump will not accept their findings. Two, During the 2016 campaign, Donald would bellow out that Hillary thinks the rules don't apply to her. Now, with Ivanka and Jared supposedly working gratis as his advisors, made more than $100 million from their business interests, from which they have not divested or put into a blind trust. I wonder how much Donald is making from his businesses.
Mm-hmm. I wondered about that a little bit, in that our intelligence operations have been under fire, certainly from the president, but also because of, you know, what happened in Iraq years ago. And I wonder if that's a little bit why these other foreign countries are holding back a little bit, in that, you know, how are we so sure after a week that this is Iran? You know, I don't think that the bombers were wearing uniforms.
Or flying the Iranian flag.
Right.
Yeah.
We go to Dave, who says, hello, panel. Not only does skepticism of our allies underscore the credibility deficit of the Trump administration, but let's also remember that the administration jammed the equivalent of a thumb in the eyes of our allies by not only unilaterally withdrawing from the agreement, but then dictating terms to our allies who remained in the deal, telling them that the U.S. would penalize them if they did business with Iran under terms of the agreement, which they chose to abide. So it's Trump's way or the highway. Is it then any wonder we're left stranded now on the side of the road?
Well, fortunately, I think they're taking a little bit of time in deciding, our allies, and that probably takes a little bit of the brouhaha out of this quote-unquote crisis that's going on. There was one explanation in a New York Times story that Iran might have put these, might be deliberately put these bombs or these mines on the sides of the tankers above the waterline, where they're much less vulnerable. The tankers are much less vulnerable to them, to demonstrate that they could easily go in and out and do it, and it's sort of a just show of force, the way we might show a force by putting 2,500 sailors over in the Mideast. You know, it's a dance, a ballet. It's something that historically happens where we all show off what we can do without necessarily doing it, and that again is speculation and it's nuance and it's not capturable in 141 characters. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many other items to discuss. We'll do just that right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you aboard. Let me read some more letters and then we'll move on to other topics. A topic that just about an hour ago, the panelists were worried that they would not be able to fill any time talking about.
It's
and I'd
true.
Just like to point out that it's you've been doing pretty good. We're going on an hour now. So Stephen writes to us and says, Libby is completely on point. I love her. Will war and the increasing manufactured chaos in the Mideast undercut any investigations of the administration, as people will reflexively rally around the flag/president? I'll let the panel answer that. I will hand the letter to Libby so she can frame it at home.
You know, I do get these. I also get these. But thank you.
You're very welcome.
I love her. That's thank you, Stephen.
Him, yeah.
Whoever you are.
Okay,
I
so
really
the point, the rallying?
Well, we didn't all rally behind President Nixon and President Johnson in the 1960s during the Vietnam War. But it is difficult to today to not back our military. I think there's almost a cult following and support of the military and our soldiers. So we'll support them, but we might still be able to be angry at the leaders that send them off to war.
But that even of course that comes out of Vietnam, and
sure.
And also, I mean, rightfully so, of the support of our troops. But what you see increasingly is even the troops themselves questioning that, but still doing their jobs.
Right, and that's very difficult for a soldier to publicly or a military
yes.
officer to publicly disagree with the commander in chief.
Yeah.
And I don't even mean as they're on the ground, but
when they former former officers and so forth who have been very forthcoming in their concerns.
Right, right. Usually it's foreign military former military leaders who sign letters that all in agreement saying that this is not the path to follow, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's more public discord and public debate about this than there may typically have been when we see a foreign power attacking tankers.
If that really happened.
I mean, but if this had happened during the Eisenhower administration, during the Kennedy-Nixon administration, Reagan administration, you probably wouldn't hear this kind of debate about whether that was legitimate.
Yes, a much different debate around it. I agree. Yeah.
The debate would be, what are we going to do about it? The problem is we can't trust what comes out of this White House.
So Dean makes a point, which is, I'm not so sure that Trump doesn't want a war with Iran. He surely knows that wartime presidents are more likely to get voted back into office. So that's a question of how cynical do we want to be. Mm-hmm. But we do know that wag the dog works, right?
Yes.
Why change horses in the middle of the stream, you know?
I think it's tough for him to, I don't see the poll numbers there of people wanting this. He's got his two big issues of trade with China and illegal immigration. He sees those as the gifts that keep on giving. And I don't see this as benefiting him.
But let's also not forget, he just fired his pollsters. Right?
No, not all of them.
Well, he just fired some
that,
of them.
The ones that agreed with him.
The ones
that leaked the information that he's down in the polls. I mean, so.
I can't believe also that the pollsters leaked the information. It was clearly someone in his White House that he is still there.
Or somebody in the poll working for the pollsters.
The article that I read said that the reason for the leaking was that they were concerned. They supported the president, and they were concerned, and they were trying to get the information out that, it isn't great. They're not there
anymore.
He's going to be firing a lot of pollsters, I think.
Yeah.
Well, what happens, it's the pattern. It's the somebody felt that the White House wasn't Trump was not understanding that he really faces challenges going into 2020. So they leak it to Fox News. He watches Fox News, and then he sees it. And that's how he learns things.
Although Paul Begala made a very good point yesterday on CNN when he was appearing on Jake Tapper's program along with George Will, who I never thought would be a hero of mine. But he's getting to be that point. He is a legend.
He's one of the conservatives that actually speaks frankly.
His new book is amazing. And he's amazing. But anyway, Paul Begala made the point. He said, look, you look at the 2000 and the 2012 election and Barack Obama and his reelection campaign, his internal polling showed him down in exactly the same states that Trump was seen down in. And he won by a very comfortable margin. The point being, they don't mean much at this point.
Excellent point. Yeah, I mean, we have more than a year,
right,
before they really begin to matter, and even then,
and even then, I think you're never going to see this president ahead in the polls ever. He was never ahead in the polls on Hillary.
Nobody wants to admit he's
never going to be ahead in the polls in 2020.
Jason says the reason our allies, that is in quotes, doesn't trust us is that we fake the intelligence in Iraq and the run-up to the invasion. We have no credibility. It's not just Trump. It goes back.
I think that's a good point. It's not – Trump is not the only president to raise a lot of bluster about a foreign enemy and try to enlist the support of our allies to put pressure on the enemy and knock out the enemy if that's necessary or we regard it as necessary. And it wasn't the first time when George W. Bush did it in Iraq. I mean,
look at Vietnam.
Yeah.
So here are two letters that are a very have very different perspectives, which is why I love when people write this way. Sean says, have we for well, actually, so Sheila writes, can someone please explain what Iran's dastardly deeds have been? Other than the U.S.'s continued interference in the Middle East, which happens to be Iran's backyard over the years, at the moment the U.S. is fighting a proxy war on behalf of the unholy alliance between the Sunni Saudis and Israel. The media has been simply accepting the American government's labeling of Iran as a terrorist state, which does nothing other than influence public opinion. Then Sean from Cambridge weighs in and says, have we forgot Iran funds Hezbollah and other jihadists and are bad actors throughout the Middle East? Please don't make them out to be a good regime. Remember that they want the extermination of Israel, our biggest ally.
You have some very sophisticated listeners.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody's saying that Iran's are good guys in all of this, not by a long shot.
Right. That's what makes it complicated.
It is all complicated. Okay. We are going to move on. Let's just do a story that is quick and something we're going to save the political stuff for when we come back. But Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first democratically elected president, died, was in court. Was on trial in a Cairo courtroom on Monday, 6 years after the military ousted him in a tumultuous circumstance that pushed Egypt back to autocratic rule. The Egyptian authorities gave no official cause of death, but critics blame the poor conditions in the prison where Mr. Morsi had spent the past 6 years. They said the authorities had deprived him of vital medicine for diabetes, high blood pressure, and liver disease, held him in a solitary confinement for long periods, and ignored repeated public warnings that the lack of proper medical care could be fatal. His death was a somber milestone in Egypt's ill-fated democratic transition after the Arab Spring in 2011. Mohamed Morsi goes into court and then keels over. He passes out and then is declared dead a few moments later.
That's well, some story.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, dramatic. It's pretty tragic. It does sound that the conditions in the prison where he was kept. I mean, even in when he was in court, he was inside this little glass booth, which must be awful. And it doesn't sound like they did anything to watch out for his health. But getting back to the problem of the Arab Spring was that I think everybody thought, this is it. This is the Middle East is going to go democratic and democracies are going to prevail. And then they elect somebody who a lot of people didn't want. And the military stepped back in and ousted him. And certainly the United States was aware of all that. You know, it just shows you that trying to maneuver and manipulate and build democracies doesn't always work.
No. Yeah. I remember not thoughtful, but hopeful people were about the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
And,
I mean,
you know, they were, I remember how hopeful, when I was a student at the University of Buffalo, there were kids from Iran in my dorm. I was in the international dorm, and they were so hopeful for bringing down the Shah, and then see what happens.
Right.
You know, so when religious fundamentalism mixes up with politics, this is what happens. So we have to be very careful.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We do welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We have a lot more to talk about. We'll get all political on you when we come back.
You mean we haven't been?
Well, panel at, yeah, we have been, but more so. Okay. Presidential politics and all that. Okay. We'll be back right after this. I'm sorry, Mike. We were talking. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. The music
oops,
just went out. I was checking in with Libby. I needed some information as to what was correct. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the roundtable.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Well, I always check with you. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. Alan is off today. We do have Mike Spain, we have J.P. Miller, and Libby Post with us, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Tonight is the night. Orlando, Florida. SmackDown Orlando 2019, as President Trump prepares to formally launch his re-election bid, or re-election bid, as they say in the States. His allies are trying to tamp down headlines that depict his campaign as trailing top Democrats, beset with withering leaks and unable to keep internal tensions from spilling into public view. To which I ask, is this a new problem? The 2020 drama intensified over the weekend as Trump's campaign abruptly fired three of its pollsters, including one firm formerly owned by Kellyanne Conway, the president's advisor and former campaign manager. Privately and publicly, campaign advisors fumed over the leak of internal polling data that showed Trump far behind former President Joe Biden in key states, a pattern that has touched a nerve with the president. Meanwhile, the president is looking to change the subject on Tuesday at the rally, where he will address a crowd he has already described as record size. That's right. He'll be joined by First Lady Melania Trump, Vice President Pence, and several members of his family and the 2016 campaign staff. So this will be a greatest hits moment tonight in Orlando.
Oh, God.
Well, some of us were speculating a little while ago. What, hasn't he already announced several times that he's running for re-election? But I guess there has to be a formal announcement. We saw it back in 2015 down in Trump Tower when he came down the escalator, and he didn't have a big crowd. In fact, there were credible news agencies reported that some people had to be paid to be part of the crowd.
Absolutely.
But then he attacked immigrants, and he came up with the bad hombres, and he called Mexican immigrants, you know, rapists and murderers. And suddenly he didn't need to pay anybody to show up at his rallies. It's pretty remarkable. I guess immigration will probably be on the agenda tonight.
I think that's a safe bet. He will be speaking at the Amway Center.
Make up your own. Some people regard as a pyramid scheme.
Make up your own joke on that.
Perfect.
But he is expected
that,
to
probably fill
that's absolutely perfect.
18,500 seat Amway Center, and the Trump advisors say they are expected to fill it. And they say those supporters are not paying attention to internal machinations of the campaign and will not be swayed by early signs of turbulence. They believe that the momentum will start the kickoff will start a momentum that will sustain through Election Day next year. The theme, promises made, promises kept. He will point to the strong U.S. economy and a slew of actions that he has taken on issues including taxes, military spending, and judicial appointments.
I think, as I said earlier, I think that we're likely to see him down in the polls from now until Election Day. I also think that those that think that maybe this will be a more disciplined on-message campaign because he is the sitting president will be disappointed. This is going to continue to be, I think, a chaotic, junior varsity operation for his reelection. I think you'll see likely a couple of different campaign managers running the campaign, a number of campaign managers and aides fired. An incumbent president, I think, with a strong economy, if the economy is still strong in November 2020, those things that are of course, weaknesses may not matter. I think he still has a chance of getting reelected.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the economy because that is a long time from now. And certainly I hope the economy stays strong because when it is weak, it a lot of people suffer. But the economy has been growing since 2011, and it continues to grow. He takes the credit for it. He does get some credit because he, during his time, the taxes were cut, and that did pump some money back into the economy, never mind our trillion-dollar deficit that hasn't really been closed. But so the economy will be a big part of his future. But I did see that the Federal Reserve may lower interest rates tomorrow, which is a sign of a weakening economy, which is a little bit frightening. It'll be November 2020 is a ways away, as they say.
And then On the other side of the aisle, we go to the front runner on the Democratic side. I know I will get mail for calling Joe Biden the front runner on the Democratic side, but I think that is accurate.
Although the polls are showing that, which polls you want to believe, and so far Biden hasn't fired any of his pollsters that we know of.
Well, and I have not seen any poll that has shown anyone but Joe Biden at the in the lead. But okay. Anyway, the gap between former Vice President Joe Biden and more liberal candidates for the presidential nomination was on display Monday before activists at a candidates forum in Washington, where representatives of the Poor People's Campaign grilled the hopefuls on their approaches to poverty and racism. Biden outlined a new health care proposal which would build on the Affordable Care Act by increasing access for lower-income people. The former vice president's tack on health care is less sweeping than the Medicare for All plan embraced by some Democratic rivals, which they touted later on stage. His divergence from the other candidates was on display, and some say that the reaction was muted. The Poor People's Campaign is a clergy-led effort to revive the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s push to focus attention and resources on poverty. At the group's forum in Washington, nine of the Democratic presidential candidates, so only like a quarter of them, showed up to make their case on how to best fight poverty in the current economic landscape.
Well, the health care proposal that Biden made was building on Obamacare, expanding it, getting around the states that don't expand Medicare and Medicaid to their, there's probably 20-something states that don't exercise that option, which is made available under the Affordable Care Act, and people can't take advantage of it in those states. So this is a way around it. It's to make sure more people are covered. But it also is appealing, I think, to moderate people who are a little worried about the price tag of Medicare for All. It's purportedly in the trillions. Arguably, if they did it, the cost of health care for society would go way down and society would benefit. And it's just a little bit of, act of faith to go to Medicare for All, because you don't really know whether it's going to deliver what it promises to the national treasury. And that was just like the tax cut. You know, they said by giving corporate taxes and the rich a big tax cut, they'll be generating a lot more economic activity, and therefore the money will come back into the treasury. Well, that hasn't happened yet either. I mean, these are scaring people on both sides. So I think Biden is being true to himself. He's going to be a moderate. He's going to try to appeal to the traditional, more moderate Democrats and Republicans, while trying to satisfy people on the left in the Democratic Party who are demanding better health care.
And the people on the left need to get a grip that if Joe Biden is the nominee, that's who we have to vote for. Because what's the most important thing, and I will say this until November 2020, is replacing Trump. And we can't let the perfect get it in the way of the good. No one's going to be perfect for everybody, you know, but what do we have? What's the option that we have here? You know, are we going to try to get someone on the far left elected? It's never going
to
happen.
But it's a little bit early to make to assume that Joe Biden will retain his leadership in the polls. I think
yes.
I think Jeb Bush was about here in 2015.
Absolutely. So yeah. We just need to recognize that it could be Biden, it could be Harris, it could be Buttigieg, it could be somebody else of the millions
Bernie,
that
Elizabeth
are running.
Warren.
It could be Warren. But the thing is that whoever it is, we all have to coalesce behind that person. That's the message.
I've been really impressed with Biden's campaign so far. It's not easy to come in as a front runner and mm-hmm. retain that lead and not step on your own words. And also, he's getting attacked by the more progressives in the party, and to withstand that pressure to flip-flop on those issues is a testament to him that he's looking at the long game. He's looking to win the general. Another thing that I've seen over the last couple of weeks that I've been very impressed with is Elizabeth Warren is taking vote share away from Bernie Sanders, which yes. I think that is the
yeah.
toughest
yeah, that's the
one person
to
take yeah. vote share from. If you're taking yeah. votes from Bernie Sanders, that's like really impressive, and I'm excited to see it. Are the debates next week?
I believe 25th,
so. 25th, right?
25th. So that's
25th.
Next week, isn't
it's
it?
It's going to be awesome. Must see TV.
Yeah.
Or radio if you're going to listen to it.
Two nights.
And Elizabeth Warren is beginning to get some traction. Mm-hmm. Kind of quietly, all of a sudden, you look and she's like number three catching up to number two, Bernie Sanders. And that's very interesting. But the, Biden does have a tough role. To be the front runner, everybody is going to be taking yes. shots at him. I was disappointed to see in that story in the New York Times about the Poor People's Campaign rally that Biden wasn't sharp. He got stopped. He didn't finish his sentences. You know, he didn't finish his they had to cut him short because he was using more than the allotted time. And he just seemed not to not to be as attuned to what they were looking for, which was quick, sharp, 4-minute speeches by each candidate. And that, you know, that's if he doesn't, you know, kind of clean up his game a little bit and get a little bit faster on the response, I think it's going to open the door for Trump to make, I think, what is a wildly false assertion that he's slow, old Joe, you know.
Yeah.
But he's got to deal with a lot of people who are trying to get a lot of information in a very short period of time, don't you think?
Yeah, and going back to what you said about Jeb Bush, as you mentioned, seemed to be the best candidate until people saw him up on the debate stage, and I think that you know with the way our news media is. It's not just the debate. It's where are those clips of how Biden is going to do with the quips and the jokes and taking the arrows. And that was something Jeb really fell flat on. It
yes.
cratered his campaign. And if Joe comes out strong, and he can be excellent in a
yeah,
debate.
Yeah, he can be. Yeah.
I think he can continue to solidify his lead. But if he is slow and that kind of thing,
just
that,
being
that's a
deliberate.
Big danger
I mean,
for
just
him,
trying
you know?
To be deliberate and not step out of line, it may backfire on him. And you're right, Jeb Bush looked like a deer in the headlights when Trump started attacking him. But Joe Biden knows the way Trump does that. And he has, when he was vice president and even in the recent past, he has answered really well. You know, I mean, he seems capable of countering the Trump rhetoric and calling Trump out. And that's something Jeb Bush just failed to do. I think he just was unprepared for
well,
that.
I don't think anybody.
That kind of brutal.
I don't think any of the Republicans were prepared for
right.
that kind of brutality. And that's what it was. Trump acted like a thug and a bully. You know, I think Joe's been very disciplined and he seems to have weathered the Hyde Amendment issue.
Got it out of the way early.
Yeah. You know, and so we'll have to wait and see what happens as this goes on. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is gaining some traction. Whether she is the right person to be in the White House or whether she should stay in the Senate, you know, I think is something for people to debate.
I mean, the big point that's being made on, I think, the news, cable news shows and other places is that, as you mentioned, Mike, just a second ago, that Biden is somewhat restrained, but they're putting – he's done this before. I mean, many people have complained that one of his downsides is that he – this is his fourth time running for president. But also in that, you have a guy who has the experience of what it is to run, now running as a front runner, and the campaign seems to so far be doing a good job of – protecting him from himself.
Yes.
Right. What I'm interested to see if some of the Democrats, you know, there's a lot of them, as you pointed out, Joe, some of the ones who are more on the progressive side, who may not have a chance to get the nomination, it may turn out, their numbers won't carry it, if they begin to take their gloves off and start to attack Joe Biden, you know, and he's got vulnerabilities, you know, because he's been around a long time, and you can't be around that long without having some some baggage. And if they do that on behalf of others,
He's taken a lot of votes in the Senate,
right? So you can always find something that was going to offend some interest group that he supported in order to get something else through. You know the way that works, but that's nuanced, and people don't like that. But
I'm not in this age of hitting you over the head with
the article, and I didn't pull it for today, but. There was an article I was reading about, as far as the money goes, of some of the real deep pocket donors very interested in Pete Buttigieg.
Yes.
And that is interesting, too. Again, back to Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush certainly had the money, but didn't have the momentum, as you pointed out, JP, on the debate stage. We'll see what Mayor Pete can do on that regard.
Yeah, I caught a little bit of his C-SPAN speech. You know, they're doing the Road to the White House again this year, which is great. They'll show an entire speech and they won't comment on it. They'll just present it. I saw one of his speeches the other night, Buttigieg's, and he's really smart.
He is. And
you know, if people get to see that, you know, it's what JP was just saying. It's whether you can break out during next week's two nights of debates to have a quip, a quick response, a brilliant statement that can become part of a campaign, that can be reiterated in ads and sent out over the internet. That'll be, unfortunately, that's going to determine who's going to survive.
The other thing too about Buttigieg, I saw the Axios piece that he did on HBO, and the one thing, and this is solely anecdotal and my observation, but the only person I have seen in recent political memory that could do what he's doing right now, which is answering a question and not sounding like a politician, was John McCain. Now, McCain wasn't real good at it on the campaign trail when he was a presidential candidate, but prior to that, he was really good at it. And Buttigieg seems that way. It doesn't come off as a political wish list. He listens, he answers the question, and as you pointed out, Mike, very smart, but the answers are nuanced, and too nuanced? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was impressed a couple of weeks ago when the president likened his photo to a cartoon character or a magazine character. I won't even mention who, but he said he looked like that guy. And somebody asked Buttigieg about it, and he says, yeah, that's sort of his line of thinking, and then just changed the subject. I mean, he wasn't going to address such a silly criticism that he happens to look like somebody in a cartoon, you know. I've got important things to talk about. I thought that was...
He's not going to take the bait.
Right.
That's the thing about Pete Buttigieg. He is not going to take the bait. He's a lot smarter than Trump is, and he has credentials. You know, he didn't have bone spurs. He went to Afghanistan.
He is a
Rhodes Scholar. He does have executive experience in government. He knows what he's doing. And he does have Wall Street is interested. And of course, the gay community is interested. And so it'll be interesting to see if he can make it. And polling is showing that America might very well be ready for a gay president. So
and
we'll see.
Buttigieg also, because he's young, he has the luxury of this is not his last campaign. He's in the process, I think, now of building a brand among the media and among thought leaders in the country that say, boy, even if this isn't the nominee this time, this guy has a tremendous future and a great brand as an elected official.
I agree with you. I do think, though, the part of that brand is the fact that he's so young and that he's a millennial and that he is speaking to that generation, but... And obviously, we all get older.
Right. Regardless of how he does in this campaign, he's got a bright future ahead of him, and we'll hear more from him, I think, if he doesn't succeed this time.
We will hold it there. My thanks to our wonderful panel, Mike Spain, J.P. Miller, and Libby Post. We will be back tomorrow with another panel, and we will be back with more show right after this short break.